I am now going to interview Irene Retty, who has a lot of professional, creative, and personal history with Gloria. So maybe we can start with that, Irene. We were talking before about how she's someone whose work has really inspired and been so important for so many people, among which I would count myself, both personally, creatively, just in a lot of ways. But that's still different than the kind of really direct, fruitful, personal interaction that you've shared with her. So I was wondering if, just to contextualize your role in Entre Mundos, if you could say a little bit about that.
Well, my connection with Gloria on a personal level started in 1992 when I moved into the upstairs of her house on Lighthouse Point in Santa Cruz, not knowing at all that she actually lived there, because I was renting the space from the woman who had bought the house with her. But actually, way before I had a personal connection with Gloria, which I'll talk about more in the piece I'll read in a few minutes from Entre Mundos, I started a feminist press in 1984 and was very inspired by This Bridge as an anthology of collective feminist voices, and also a multi-genre anthology, to start to produce feminist anthologies of my own. And at the time I was very young, and This Bridge was a great model for me, as well as, of course, it completely opened up my ideas of feminism itself.
So do you want to say anything more just to contextualize, or would you rather just, does it speak for itself in your piece?
I think it speaks for itself, and then perhaps we could talk more after I actually read it.
Okay. So this is a piece that you contributed to Entre Mundos, which we were just talking about with Ana Louise Keating.
Okay, this is called Living in the House of Nepantla. And Ana Louise earlier was mentioning Gloria's concept of Nepantla as a liminal space, a space between borders, a space of possibility. Begins with an epigram from Unnatural Bridges. Nepantla becomes the place you live in most of the time, home. The year was 1992. I moved into the upstairs of a house in Santa Cruz, California. The place was a writer's dream. A loft, wood stove, skylights, a deck, and best of all, a view of the ocean only a block away. The house belonged to Gloria Anzaldúa. Gloria's books, This Bridge Called My Back, and Borderlands, had shaped my feminism, particularly my understanding of women of color. Her work had also been a catalyst in strengthening my identity as a Jewish woman. My parents, who are both Holocaust refugees, had kept their past and their Jewish heritage a secret from me. When I read Gloria's writing, I was inspired to understand my own struggles with assimilation. Carrying all of this admiration for Gloria's books intensified my usual shyness. For the first week, I almost avoided Gloria. I couldn't believe I was living upstairs from this incredible woman. Some of this shyness ebbed a few afternoons later, when Gloria came out of her house carrying a dozen seed packets. "Can you use some of these?" she asked in her gentle voice. I was about to plant a garden. "My mother gave these to me, and I've been saving them." She began shuffling the seeds like a pack of cards. "Here's corn and squash and beans and tomatoes. Oh, and here are some sunflowers." I laughed and accepted some seeds. Soon we were taking walks along the ocean, discussing our writing, our lives. Before long, I could not believe that I had been so shy around her. We became friends. We have walked this journey into memory and history on parallel paths for 9 years. Me, upstairs, researching and writing a memoir. Her, downstairs in her study, writing stories and essays, sometimes all night. We are heirs to separate histories. Where is the border between us, between Chicana and Jew? Gloria's concept of Nepantla seems to me to be the perfect metaphor for our house. She has written, quote, "Living between cultures results in seeing double, first from the perspective of one culture, then from the perspective of another," unquote. But what happens when two women from different cultures inhabit the same space? Perhaps the house itself begins to see double, becomes a vortex of intense creativity, or, as Gloria writes, a zone of possibility. I was baptized Unitarian and attended Congregationalist and Catholic schools. Now I am both a cultural and spiritual Jew, a feminist, and also a lesbian. I live in the space between the Shoah and the atom bomb and the questionable future. The bracing and invigorating crosswinds of Nepantla have become home. Does Nepantla shimmer between our cups of decaf as we write at the local coffee house, or reside somewhere in the floorboards that separate my feet from her head as we move through our days? These separations are not trivial. They are part of what define our house. I am the light-skinned Jew in my family, she the dark one in her family, La Prieta. I was raised middle class in Los Angeles, California, the daughter of a civil engineer. She picked cotton in rural South Texas. There are 18 years between us, yet our mothers are the same age. I wonder whether our neighbors have any idea what transpires within the walls of this wood-shingled house with blue trim. Who do these white people who surround us see when this short Chicana woman walks by twice each day? Who do they see when they look at me, and how do they see us differently? Two women writers live in a house by the sea, a house filled with books. Sometimes I think this little house will explode from the very power of us. I am not only a writer, but also the publisher of Her Books Feminist Press, my back room a wall of boxes of published titles. But these walls are more than just material walls. They contain our tears, our breathing, our dreams, our love, and our isolation. They contain our spirits, and they speak the common language of writing. Here we flourish, two women who care more about writing than home maintenance. The rose bushes and blueberries cry out for water, and the decks of our old house rot like an old ship. So, we will not be remembered for our housekeeping. Our hands stroke keyboards while the weeds grow ever higher, weave a marvelous jungle for my cats, whom she too has come to love. When I go on vacation, she becomes cat mama. Two black cats have suddenly made cameo appearances in her writing. Here we are, two women who speak the common language of writing, who respect the privacy writing demands. Out of respect for that privacy essential to creativity, we never drop by unannounced, but instead call each other on the phone or even use email. What shall I call Gloria? Certainly not landlady, but she's not quite a housemaid either. She calls me her comadre in writing. She is a key editor of my memoir. I read drafts of her stories, help her wrangle with contracts, editors, and publishers. We've gone to the same writing colonies. For my birthday, she gives me a special leather-bound blank journals with creamy, smooth Italian paper. This year, her inscription reads, "Para mi comadre Irene, otro librito para otro proyecto." Next to the inscription, she has drawn a bird woman with open arms like wings. I looked at this drawing and realized it was Gloria. I have many writing companions, but there is no one else with whom I share such a rich cultural and political context. Once a week, we make the short trip downtown to our favorite coffee house, where we swoop down on a table as soon as a student leaves and write, she relishing a decaf while I eat the sweets that she, as a diabetic, cannot have. Sometimes before we work, she reads the astrology column to me in a voice full of portent and drama, accompanied by many significant looks. Sometimes we talk before we write. We tell each other when we are lonely, when our bodies hurt, when the writing is not going well. Sometimes we arrive ecstatic over the publication of a book, or simply share the joy of the writing itself. I know the diabetes wears at Gloria's strength and spirit. When I don't hear her voice below my bedroom, talking on the phone, or when I notice her mail still sitting in the mailbox, I worry a little. I try to keep myself from terrible visions of Gloria passed out on the floor of her house from a hypo episode. But Gloria is strong and determined. Sometimes I look out my window and see her hacking the bamboo plant that is always threatening to take over the backyard. One day when we cleaned out the garage, I got tired after a few hours, and went inside to rest. She said she was going to go inside and take her insulin and rest, but a little while later I heard her downstairs, still working, fiercely stubborn. We both struggle to take care of ourselves, to slow down. Diabetes has become her spiritual teacher. I write this in a house of Nepantla, a house by the sea at the edge of North America, a house inhabited by a Jewish woman whose parents survived destruction and a Chicana woman who survived racism. The borders of history and personal life cross and crisscross, propel us deeper into Nepantla. I live upstairs from this remarkable woman. We have become family. And that was written in June 2001.
Thank you so much for reading that. And I know that your connection to her did not end in 2001 or even in 2004 at her death. You've been very much involved with her presence since then. We were talking about the archive a little bit before, and I know that all our listeners should know that Irene is an extremely experienced archivist for whom all those who use McHenry Library should be grateful. But could you say a little bit perhaps about the archive that Alexis and Ana Luis were talking about and your role in mediating that?
Well, I was very aware that In Gloria's house was an absolute treasure that absolutely could not be lost. I mean, I would have thrown my body over it if I had to, to make sure that all of these drafts that Ana Luis was talking about, all of these poems, all of these drafts of Borderlands, of this bridge, all of the editing, there's so much in this archive. There, like Ana Luis said, there's about 100 tapes of interviews that she did, and all of that is being in photographs and just everything you could imagine. But the work that it took Ana Luis and I and Kit Kwan, who is very much involved as well as one of Gloria's closest friends, the three of us spent days and days and days and days in the house organizing this material and then getting it into a form. I mean, Gloria had started to organize it, but finishing that organizational process and then getting it in shape to go to the Benson Latin American Library at the University of Texas at Austin, where it's now in the process of being cataloged and finding aid to everything in it would be created, and all of the tapes are going to be digitized and preserved. They have the resources there to do the right work with it, and it will be open to the public in about a year.
So was there any sort of conflict or negotiation that had to happen over what was going to happen to it, where it was going to go?
It was very clear that, you know, Gloria came from Texas. Her family still lives there. And we were very lucky that there was a public university with the kind of expertise and resources to take proper care of this collection right in Texas that wanted the collection. So it was kind of a no-brainer that was the right place for it to go. That, you know, Gloria's body went home to Texas when she died. Her family she's buried in very near to where she grew up, and that her body of work should also return to Texas, to the borderlands that she wrote about, to the landscape that she wrote about in Borderlands.
Mm-hmm. And so there's all this material of the archive, that wasn't the only thing that she left behind either. And I know another thing that you've been very involved in is this Living Memorial Project, which I would love to hear more about.
In addition to all of the papers that Gloria left and the tapes and photographs, all over Gloria's house, she had altars, which had, I mean, everywhere from on top of her computer to in the bathroom, in the bedroom, in the living room, of course, but in her study, anywhere you could imagine, even in her car, she had a little altar. And these altars were an integral part of her writing process because she saw writing as a spiritual practice. And she called on the spiritual world when she was writing. And she did not believe she was doing this writing alone. And as part of her process of writing, she would use these altars. She would light a candle, she would light sage, she would light incense, and she would call on a variety of different indigenous and Catholic and all kinds of traditions. I mean, she had Kabbalistic stuff in her altar. She had a whole variety of richness that you would expect from someone as eclectic as Gloria. So all over her house, we found these altars of what she called her animales, which were little lizards and snakes. And those of you who know her writing know, especially from Borderlands, how much she talks about La Serpiente. And, you know, this was a literal thing for her, that she actually had there was a snake that came into her house, sometimes uninvited, but I think it really liked to be with her. And it would come through her front door. There was a little hole where there was this plant, and the snake would come in, but it clearly knew where it was going. I never saw it in my house, let's just say. So these altars, we really struggled with, what do we do with these altar objects? Because yes, the Benson Latin American Library would have been happy to take them, but they did not have the resources, nor do really any libraries, to create a permanent exhibit of these archives, I mean, of these altars within the context of her writing. And so our fear was that they were going to be, you know, put in nice boxes and preserved, and basically like maybe taken out once every 10 years, you know, a couple little lizards would see the light of day, mm-hmm. and that would be it. And I've done quite a bit of coalitional work with the Native American community earlier in my life, and I was very aware of the problem of artifacts, or I don't even like that word, but of our sacred objects being taken out of the context of the cultures in which they're used and put in museums behind glass, and or perhaps never even seen at all, and that these are living you know, pieces of our community. They need to be kept alive. So Valerie Chase, who's a good friend of mine, who also knew Gloria and lived with her for a little while in the house in the early 90s, she and I came up with the idea of having a memorial altares project. And this all sort of came together, it seems meant to be, because I direct the oral history project at McHenry Library. And another job I've had at the library in the past is as exhibit coordinator. So all of a sudden it came to me, oh, and then the third thing I forgot to say is that we are in the process of building an addition to McHenry Library, which will contain a number of small and medium-sized study rooms. And so all of a sudden it came to me, like, we could have a room in the new building that we would have as a memorial to Gloria. But I didn't want to just see, you know, a plaque on the wall with Gloria's name on it with no context. And I thought, wow, we could have this room, and we could have cases in the room in which we would have a rotating exhibit of these altar objects, and then also put them in the context of her writing, and so that it would not just be like we're just putting all these, like, you know, snakes and lizards and mm-hmm. jaguars and, you know, Virgin candles and pictures of Gloria without any context of what they mm-hmm. meant to her. But then the final thing that we thought about is, we don't even want them just to sit in the case. We want there to be active programming on an ongoing basis that will actually use these altar objects in the way that Gloria would have wanted them used. So for instance, Gloria, when she taught writing workshops, she would actually use these objects. She would light a candle. And I've spoken to people who were lucky enough to take these classes, and she would embody that practice that she had in the privacy of her house. She would do in the workshop. So the idea we have is that perhaps, the dream we have is that perhaps in the future somebody will be able to teach a workshop using some of Gloria's writing, teaching techniques and meditations, and using the objects themselves, you know, just for that day, that people could be doing free writes or, you know, whatever comes to them through looking at these.
And is that one of the ways that she would use them in her classes?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yes.
So the announcement, that there was a dedication in October, I believe, at the Wound Center. And one of the things they mention is enrichment programs. Is that what they're referring to, like to be used in writing workshops and things
yes.
like that?
Yes. Yeah, so that we are not waiting. The room will not be complete for 4 years because this is, you know, we're talking a big building here that has to be constructed, and I'm sure some of your listeners have seen the beginning of the construction going on at McHenry. So we don't want these objects to be sitting in boxes for the next 4 years. So we had a couple of ideas of ways to start right away. And so one of them was the Women's Center raised money so that they could get a special case. And we installed an altar down, which is going to be up there permanently, and we'll rotate the exhibit. And we had a dedication which coincided with the 20th anniversary of the Women's Center itself. And Gloria was, her vision of Crossing Borders was an inspiration for some of the early directors of the Women's Center, because that Women's Center crosses both the community and the campus's boundaries. And she was herself was on the board for a while there, mm-hmm. in the early years, so, and did several events there, like a Borderlands reading. And so we felt that it was really appropriate that the first installation of Ansel Duros Altares would be at the Women's Center in a community context. And then secondly, I'm just about to install an exhibit at McHenry Library, which will run for the entire winter quarter, which will be the Altares, and in the context of her writing. And it's a memorial exhibit for Gloria. So I hope that people will be able mm-hmm. to come by. It'll be up all of winter quarter, right in the reference area, so you can't possibly miss it.
Great, right, when you come in the front door.
Yeah.
So how many altars are we talking about in total?
Oh.
Do you have any idea?
Well, you know, she would change them constantly, but there were probably 10 different sites within her house, maybe a little bit more. Some of the altars were really small. And there are about 17 or 18 boxes, archival boxes and material. So it's an extensive collection.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of images as well as the objects themselves. So, for instance, she had quite a collection of Frida Kahlo cards or other figures that she wrote about in her writing that she would collect the images of. So these were also part of her altars.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then there's even just like her sage, and, you know, there's a lot of different
mm-hmm.
things.
Do you have any idea who might be people that would use these in teaching?
Well, I can already tell you that Aida Hurtado is bringing her her class to come in the
mm-hmm.
winter, and I'm going to do a little talk, you know. And then also, there's a class at Cabrillo in ESL class that's the teacher from that and already knows about this because she was at the dedication of the altar in October, and she's going to bring her class, which she's used Ansel Duros' work for years in her class, you know,
mm-hmm.
because of, you know, the way that she does the code switching, and she does the the poetry that's in Spanish, and on her students really love Ansel Duros' work, and
mm-hmm.
and then there's another class that may come as well. So it's, and that's even, you know, without the exhibit being installed yet. So
mm-hmm.
I could definitely see that. And then in addition, for instance, there was a graduate student who came to the dedication in October, who's working on her dissertation, and she's using this whole method of writing as spiritual practice inspires her personally, and it's kind of unorthodox in the academy, but she has found that this method is working for
mm-hmm.
her in doing the writing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's all kinds of ways that we couldn't even imagine that
yeah.
these altares might get used, and that Ansel Duros kind of one foot in and one foot out of the academy will continue.
Yeah, that's one of the major ways in which she's inspired me. And I would venture to guess that the more academically unorthodox the project, perhaps the greater tribute to her that is. Speaking of which, we didn't talk about this on the air yet, did we? The matter of her doctorate, which she had completed the work for, but never actually received at the time of her death from UCSC. Is that correct?
Actually, she had I was meeting with her when I was a graduate student. I was meeting with her once a week at Lulu Carpenter's, and she was working on finishing her dissertation in literature. And she was working very intensively on it and was just very close to finishing it. And it still needs some work, but
mm-hmm.
basically we're talking final revisions and footnotes and things like that. So she was very, very close. I mean, working very closely with her committee, and Helene Moglen was on her committee, and a number of, you know, some other people.
Was that through the Feminist Studies, or it used to be called the Women's Studies Department?
No, this was literature.
Literature,
yes.
Okay.
So when Gloria died on May 15th, 2004, Helene Moglen spearheaded an effort to award her PhD degree. And this was not, I want to be very clear, because Gloria did not want an honorary degree. She wanted the real thing, mm-hmm. and she deserved the real thing, and she had done, I mean, the degree was awarded partially for her dissertation, and it was acknowledged that her dissertation was nearly complete. Secondly, it was for her body of work, which mm-hmm. clearly Borderlands mm-hmm. itself could be a dissertation, right? It's just hope. And many other manuscripts as well. So she was awarded a PhD degree and at the 2004 graduation. And I'm very glad that UCSC did acknowledge the work that she'd done and that it's not an honorary degree.
Mm-hmm. A well-earned one.
Yes.
Yeah. So before we close out our show for today, is there anything else that you want to either read or mention or just anything at all?
Just that Gloria was one of the most eclectic people that I ever knew. I mean, Gloria was interested in the geology of the California coast. She was interested in physics. She was interested in Kabbalah. She, you know, of course, was interested in feminist politics and all those things. But her vision is so, so broad. And I think that for decades and decades, we're going to be uncovering just how broad and how extraordinary her vision was. And I find that, you know, my relationship with her in body has ended, and yet her spirit is so much with me in my own writing. And I feel that it was, you know, it's been a great honor for me to work on her archive and to have her in my life.
Well, thank you for being here with us in the studio today. We're really honored that you could share all of this with us.
Thank you, Maya.
So, yeah, I'm just going to give us some more Leela Downs for the moment.
Oh, qué maravilla es esta, lo este mundo.